Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, "We are going to give women meaningful beauty." And I said, "That's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life."
Meaningful beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Oh, hi. Hello there. Welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I am your host, Liv. You know the one. 2023 is a big year for mythological retellings. And while I can't have every author of them on my show, because there are so many, it's so great, I am especially thrilled to have spoken with today's conversation guest. Rani Selvaraja has not only written a retelling of our beloved and magnificent girl, Medea, but one that is entirely different from the traditional retellings that we've all been enjoying lately. This is Medea, but in colonial India. Yeah. Savage Beasts is a new novel that tells the story of Medea through characters living through the height of the East India Trading Company in India. It's the 18th century, Jason is a fucking colonizer named James, and Mina is a badass woman from Calcutta. So needless to say, today's episode is not only a conversation about the novel generally, but one about the story of Medea as a foreigner, so specifically as a barbarian, and how that is used in this new and so very different retelling of her story. We talked about Medea and her sourcing, we talked about the lives of migrant women, both now and then, we talk about colonialism a lot, and writing a novel about the height of it. We worked to talk about all of these deeply heavy things while also making it lighthearted, and I think we succeeded. You know, it's Medea. It was so fucking fun to talk to Rani about her new novel and all of these other seriously important topics. This is definitely one of the more powerful and timely conversation episodes that I've had in a while. Obviously, I truly just cannot wait for you all to hear it. It's so good. So let's get right into it. Con- Conversations, Jason as Colonizer, rewriting Medea with Savage Beasts author Rani Salvaraja. I'm so excited to talk to you today because your book is so different from what I usually do when I'm talking to authors, which is like those sort of straight retellings that are super popular right now. And those are wonderful and great. But I was so excited that there is a, you know, a quote unquote retelling of Medea that is not a straight retelling, that is not set in ancient Greece. And I just think that is so damn interesting, which is sort of my like talk around way of saying, yeah, I mean, we'll keep it spoiler free and just talk Medea, but also everything about your book that you want to say. But like, okay, before I just keep rambling, because I do that, why don't you tell me like where your book is set, what time period, because that's what's so interesting. Just tell me literally everything you want to up front, and then we will go into whatever else from there.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. This is really exciting for me.
I'm so excited. The show.
my book, my debut novel, is called Savage Beasts, and it's a retelling of Medea, but set during the 18th century, during the rise of the East India Company in India. And for anyone who doesn't know, the East India Company was at one point the largest corporation in the world, a sort of private trading company that effectively ruled most of India for about 100 years before the actual sort of British country ruled India for about 200. So it was sort of paved the way for colonialization of India. And so the book tells the story of Medea, but also tells the story of colonization and explores themes of what it's like to be a foreign othered woman and the injustices they experience that I think are really relevant and present in Medea's story, particularly as told by Euripides.
Hell yeah. Euripides is the best one, obviously. Yeah, that's what's so interesting to me. Like, I mean, I think Medea is so ripe for exactly this because of what you're saying with like, she is this foreigner. She's a, you know, quote unquote barbarian. I talk about that word all the damn time, so I won't try to remind the listeners now. But like, she's so interesting in that. And as soon as I saw that your book was going to exist, which I feel like I heard about it like a year ago now, and was like, holy shit, that sounds amazing. Because
I think it might have been a year.
I've been looking forward to it all that time. Because what made you want to tell the story that way? Mm-hmm. You know, like, what kind of spurred you to not only retell Medea, but to do it in this like really unique and like impactful way?
So I guess, I don't know, taking each part of your question, I guess what inspired me to tell Medea's story is that, first of all, she's great. Like, I love her. I think it's impossible to sort of read her story, discover it, and not be just totally captivated by her. I have the privilege of learning ancient Greek at school and studying Euripides' play at A level, so I would have been about 17 at the time, and just straight off the bat was totally captivated by her, like the strength of her character, how complex she was. And so I just really wanted to, you know, I feel like there should be tons of retellings of her, to be honest. But I think for me, potentially as a South Asian woman, what captivated me was not only that, you know, she's any woman sort of fighting against these patriarchal forces, so she absolutely is, it's her specific position as a foreign woman, and yeah, kind of how that then relates and impacts how like her specific situation and the treatment of her by other characters. So I wanted to explore that, I guess. And I think it's something that often is kind of de-emphasized when we talk about Medea. Like, I think the cultural, like, collective consciousness around Medea is that she's this woman scorned. He's just angry that her husband left her for, like, a younger woman. When, like, I think the story is so much bigger and more complex than that. So I think the Yeah, so I just feel like a retelling allows us to center that sort of aspect of that, of her identity, and look at those kind of intersecting oppressions that she experiences relating to her gender, ethnicity, and nationality. And you know, also thinking about that, we, you know, people never write like without a context. There's the context, I think, specifically in the UK and around the world in many respects, is that migrant women, migrant people are regularly demonized and denigrated and harmed by state violence and sort of harmful legislative laws. I, at the time when I was drafting Beck, it was lockdown, and I was working for an organization in the UK that campaigns for the end of violence against women, and we were specifically campaigning on the domestic abuse bill that was going through Parliament at the time, trying to ensure that migrant women had equal protection and support, because currently they don't. They run the risk of potentially being deported or detained if they go to the police to report abuse. They don't have access to mainstream refuge or women's shelters. So kind of that was very much top of my mind when I was writing the book, and wanted to kind of explore that. And I guess that's kind of why I wanted to tell Medea's story. And then thinking about setting, I guess taking then Jason's role in it, I studied the play at school, and it's been sort of on my mind for, you know, decades now, I guess. And just, you know, if you think about the myth, it's the story of this guy, he's from the West, who kind of sails in, you know, seeking adventure and fortune that all kind of enhance his status back home. He you know, comes upon this foreign land to try and take this kind of treasure, this stone, this foreign gold. He does that with you know, not really through his actions most of the time. A lot of it sort of the labor and, you know, the ingenuity of someone else.
Jason is, you know, so ridiculous, honestly. Dude does nothing for himself ever.
We can get into Jason. Hey, I'm definitely with you that Theseus is the worst. I think it's hard to argue, you know, the otherwise, but Jason feels like my personal enemy. Like, I hate it so much. But yeah, he's this guy who kind of off the back of other people's labors, you know, able to profit. And then, you know, he proceeds to treat her appallingly and disregard her whenever, you know, when it's expedient. And that felt like the story of colonization, and particularly kind of Britain's relationship with its formerly colonized people. Like in the UK, there was, you know, a couple of years ago, huge scandal where sort of generation of people who came here sort of post-war from the Caribbean, known as the Windrush generation, named after a ship that a lot of one of the ships that came over and support them here, kind of, and that was a generation that effectively built, you know, our public services, worked in the NHS, National Health Service, and that sort of thing. And they sort of came here, sort of, they were told that they would be welcome and they were needed, and they, you know, they are British citizens, and then that status was then yanked from them later in life, and they were deported. And so that just, if I know, the only way I can describe it is that just retelling Medea's story in this way during the rise of colonialism just made sense to me. Like it just felt like so perfect. And I guess particularly, but you know, my heritage is South Indian Sri Lankan, and I was interested in exploring colonialism in that region, and reading about it, you can, yeah, really start to trace the beginnings of that in 1757. So when the East India Company took effectively rule over Bengal. So it felt like, you know, fitting stop for the story, so that it could be kind of set against that historical backdrop, but then potentially also emblematic of colonization itself as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh my God, there's so many interesting things to take out of all of that. I mean, one, yeah, Jason is ridiculous, just to start it off light. But also, it's so interesting because, like, I've thought about the story of Medea in so many different ways, and like for so long. I mean, truly, she's one of the characters, like, for all the reasons that you said up front. Like, she's absolutely fascinating, and I think that there is like just an endless amount that you can kind of think about her character and all the different sources and all these different like versions and everything. There's just so much. But one thing that I've never, like, I've always seen Jason and the Argonauts as, like, you know, traveling to this foreign land and like ultimately, I kind of see Medea as, I mean, I don't want to say taken, because like obviously she does go of her own free will, but like it is the gods that cause that ultimately, you know, especially in Apollonia.
It's very murky in terms of like consent and, you know, kind of how much agency she had in that because of, yeah, divine intervention kind of causing her love, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And especially in Apollonius, like it's so obvious that she's just like, you know, like they cause her to love Jason in that way. But and I'm sure that it's the, you know, colonizer in me because I am like deeply white and in Canada and generationally white Canadian. So like just full blown colonizer, like that I've never seen it as colonialism explicitly. But like just the way you describe it, like, it, you know, it so much is like obviously they're not trying to like, you know, conquer a land or anything, but they are going to a place. Their intention is to take a thing, like they're going for the golden fleece. They're going to like take a thing from this eastern land and ultimately like take the princess back with them as well. And yeah, there's kind of so much there. And I mean, just generally, like her story is fascinating because you get this foreigner aspect. And what you were saying at the beginning too, like I agree, it's something that's not focused on enough. And I think it is being focused on more and more now because of the people that are getting voices in this field. But yeah, like that is the thing that makes her. She is a foreigner, and that is what makes her fate, particularly in Euripides, like so hard for her to manage. Like if she wasn't a foreigner, you know, objectively, I think we can say that like she wouldn't have felt like she had to kill her children in Euripides, because the whole point is that like she has nothing when Jason leaves her, because not only is she a woman, but she's a foreign woman. Like she just literally has nothing. And if he is leaving the kids with her, like they have nothing. And that, to me, that's always why she felt like she had to, like, sure, maybe not the right decision, Medea, like, you know, it happens. But like, It seems to me that that's what it is. And you're right that it's so often described more as like this wronged woman, this like spurned woman. She's so mad because he found like a younger, prettier wife. And it's like, that's so not what is happening. And it's such like this like male, like just patriarchal misogynist reading that has been just sort of like fed down our throats for so long. This idea that like, Medea is just a crazy woman who killed her kids. Like, that is such a common notion of her.
And it's just like, and it's so, like, it's so the opposite of what Euripides is trying to say in the play. Like, there's not even, like, there isn't even that much language, like, focusing on kind of, like, sexual jealousy. Like, that's what Jason kind of accuses her of. There's not, like, you know, lots of, like, language kind of comparing her to Glauke or Creusa, however kind of she's called, in terms of, like, oh, one's, like, younger and one's, and, like, hot and one's, like, you know, like, she's over the hill or whatever. Like, it's like, it's very much described about, you know, her being kind of non-Greek and, you know, being this barbarian woman, and, you know, and she's a threat because of this. And she's sort of described in this bestial language of being like, you know, that's dehumanizing, sort of a lion, a bull, all that sort of stuff. So it's, you know, very much othered in that way. And like, it's, and also on the crazy point, like, it's like, you know, I think one of the defining features of her in this way is that she's very much of sound mind when she kind of makes that decision. Yeah. She is very methodical and logical, and she knows exactly how, like, the horrors of what she's doing in the play, but she knows in her, like, to her mind that she has to do it. So yeah, it's definitely one of those examples, and I think it's something that a lot of sort of books that are doing kind of feminist retellings do look at, which is basically sort of the way that the, you know, the myths and stories have kind of come down to us over the centuries have actually kind of reinforced and added kind of extra patriarchal layers that actually aren't there in the original sources. And it's, yeah, just kind of actually about stripping that back and kind of looking at, okay, what is actually there? What is kind of what I was trying to say? And yeah, I think Euripides has like so much empathy and so, and like real kind of understands the vulnerability of her position and how it's related to her status as a foreign woman, rather than just being someone, yeah, who's jealous and scorned.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Like, yeah, I mean, everything I think that, or, you know, just like so many ways that people have been seeing these things for the past, like, say, 400 years are so emphasized in how, like, the characters are seen today. But yeah, like, that doesn't exist in Euripides. Like, Euripides has empathy for her. She is not the villain. There are still people definitely who would say that she is, but I really like, I don't read the Euripides and see her as a villain at all. Like, she does bad things, but no, and you're right, like, she is of sound mind completely. Like, Euripides knows how to write madness. He knows how to write somebody who is not there. Like, I just covered Orestes, and it's like, that's an entire play about a man who is like fighting with things in his head. Like, he's just literally like, everything is kind of just unknown and everything's just going on in his head at all times, and we don't even know what he's thinking. Like, Euripides knows how to show us somebody who is not, you know, in their right mind, and Medea is not it. She is methodical, like you said. She is like so aware of what she's doing. It's simply that she feels that that is her only option in order to, like, essentially save her children from, like, a much more horrific fate if Jason is allowed to do what he's going to do. And, like, she's so damn fascinating, and I just absolutely love her in every way. But, like, so I'm fascinated by the idea of writing her in this way. Like, I definitely want to talk more about the colonial context too, because I think that's so important. But when it comes to, like, your character, like, you're taking this story of Medea, you're putting it in this totally different setting. Like, how did you want to go about writing your character and like, just her as a person?
Yeah, so I guess it's interesting. I think kind of the further, you know, kind of further I got into the writing and editing process, I think the more I was able to create kind of my characters of Mina, who is my sort of stand-in for Medea, kind of, and make her kind of her own creation. I think definitely early drafts, I mean, the first time, first draft, had no expectation of it being published. It was just, honestly, it was just something I did to just try, you know, see if I could write a book. Just kind of like, I was slightly inspired by my partner. He had sort of grand plans of running a marathon before he turned 30, and then sort of lockdown happened. But I was just like, well, I'm never going to do anything that active and healthy. But what can I do? I'll write a book. I've always, said I like writing. And so, at the start, it was very much just for me. And I think at the beginning, there was definitely a lot of sort of influence of Medea. But then kind of taking her, sort of creating her as her, a character in her own right, I was able to then sort of think about the specific context and also take story kind of like tell Medea's story kind of as a like almost from end to end, I guess, in terms of obviously the play, it's just sort of one day in her life, and it's sort of kind of when they're in Corinth. So I was able to take it all the way back when kind of she's a young woman, she's not married, she's much younger, a lot more naive, and kind of try to then show that I guess that kind of initial innocence, and then how that's kind of how that's sort of stripped away through kind of everything that she experiences along the way with James, who is my sort of stand-in for Jason, and examine sort of what that actually kind of looks like, that process, how she becomes the incredibly fearsome, sort of determined woman at the end. And that was actually quite fun to discover. And obviously, not necessarily obviously, but my book, there isn't any divine intervention. There aren't, the Greek gods in that way. And so trying to sort of come up with reasons for, how she would come to fall in love with him, and, after so soon and everything like that, it then requires, thought about, okay, what's the context in terms of her, like, what's her family life like in terms of, maybe she's sort of lonely and, emotionally bereft of love, and that kind of, even if, particularly if you're familiar with myth, you might, see James and be like, oh no, red flag. she's actually drawn to him for lots of different reasons, and then see how that develops. It was really interesting kind of trying to come up with be inspired by mythical counterparts of of the figures in my book, but then also try and see how it could be influenced by the historical figures as well. So, for example, there's a figure who comes to be play a similar role to Creon. And he's heavily inspired by a figure from history called Robert Clive, who sometimes known as Clive of India. And he was like the first British governor of Bengal. And yeah, just even in his own time was known to be just hideously greedy and vile and, you know, judged in terms of his actions in India. Sort of contemporary satire called him Lord Vulture for everything that he sort of the huge amount of sort of wealth that he stole from India, and then in addition to that, kind of beyond the scope of the book in terms of the time frame, Robert Clive's sort of policies in terms of taxation or cultural reforms in the state resulted in a famine in 1770 where millions of Indians died. So it kind of was, in his own time, reviled for everything he did. And it's only kind of much later on in sort of 1900s when sort of start to get a slightly revisionist view of him and sort of statues erected in his honour as, you know, one of the founders of the glorious empire. So it was quite interesting kind of weaving in aspects of real life historical figures and sort of trying to meld them with their cool inspirations as well.
Yeah. Well, what a great way to weave in more talk about the colonialism aspect, because that part is so interesting. And like, oh my God, just hearing about characters like that. Like, I mean, it shouldn't be surprising. And like, ultimately it isn't, but you know, you still are just like, God, like, just how was
it talked about it, isn't it? Because
no, exactly,
deliberately not talked about it. You know, in India, they're talked about it, obviously. They, you know, know the colonial history very well, but you know, it's very as much a part of British history as it is Indian history. And yet, I've you know never been taught any of this stuff, certainly not in any great depth. And in the back of my book, if anyone's interested, I do have a little author note about kind of that goes into some of the history and recommends a little reading list if anyone's interested, because yeah, it's history that we're not taught anywhere near enough, and we should be.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just makes me think of all the Canadian colonial history, right? Like, I mean, we're taught about residential schools, and I think that it's getting better now, but like makes me wonder if the UK is taught about that at all, like the things they did in Canada to the Indigenous people. And yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah. I would imagine not, because it's I mean, it's horrific. And even like, I graduated high school like too many years ago now. But like, I barely think we learned anything. Like, I know my mom always made a point of teaching it to us, but like the last one in Canada closed in 1990. Like we were so recently horrific. And so, yeah, that, I mean, just as a white Canadian, just makes me think of all of that and everything. Yeah.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
And actually, yeah. It's something you mentioned, so Canada, just as a, you know, throughout the book, because I'm a massive myth nerd, you know, try to sprinkle kind of Easter eggs and all sort of references to plays,
yeah.
Why the myth, and yeah, kind of his, James's ship is called the Argo, because a lot of the ships that were kind of run by the Eastern Newcomers were kind of named after classical figures and classical references, because, you know, obviously they saw themselves as being, you know, kind of the inheritors of the legacy of the Romans and the Greeks. They saw themselves as this was the new great empire. So, you know, it very much was, you know, influencing their thinking. And there was a ship called the Argo that used to go between Liverpool and New Brunswick in Canada, actually.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that it's interesting that you say that. So, look, I recently learned... But I realized I didn't look into the history of this ship, but I recently learned that there was a ship, and I am now imagining that it probably was part, because I know also the East India Company, I believe they were the first ones who came over to, like, because I live on Vancouver Island, and there was, like, one of the earlier trading ports was in this area, because it's called the Nootka Sound, which is, like, on our west end of the island, and our west side of the island, and I feel it must, I'm pretty sure it was them who came in and, like, were some of the, you know, the first colonizers on this side of the country, because obviously the eastern part of our country was colonized first. But that's all to say, like, there we have this lake in town. I've talked about it on the podcast a few times, but we have this lake that's, like, sort of one of our biggest, like, swimming lakes. I feel like it isn't anymore because it's nasty now, but, like, it was. And it's called Thetis. And I had always wondered whether there was a connection, but, like, because most of our stuff out here is named for indigenous words, and I was like, maybe it's just, like, a coincidence, but no, it was named for a ship that came over, and now I'm like, oh, I wonder if that ship, and I know the ship was intentionally named for the Nereid, for Thetis, and so now, yeah, it makes me think, like, probably the ship was from that time, and was part of what you're saying, which, like, is so right about the, you know, the British Empire, of, like, this idea of inheriting quote-unquote Western civilization, right? Like, it's just, there's just so much. But this isn't about Canada or North America. Or, yeah. But I'm fascinated by the history part. So, like, it's hearing your influence for your sort of Creon stand-in is so interesting. But, like, obviously you're going to also put in a ton of other actual historical stuff, because you are working in this lens of colonialism. So, like, how much did you kind of invent, like, how much did you really want to emphasize, like, the true colonial aspects? I imagine a lot, because that's what makes it so horrible, but also, like, is so influential on your book. And just, like, yeah, I mean, I'm just fascinated by how you kind of worked in all of that sort of colonialism generally.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, whenever you're writing historical fiction, there's always kind of, yeah, that kind of decision of how much you sort of actually talk about, you know, the history and kind of incorporate that. But then you know, how much is the fiction, and, you know, how much do you sort of give yourself license to do that? And I guess kind of fundamentally, it is obviously a fictional novel, and it's, you know, inspired by a myth. So kind of the, I guess, core storyline of it, it does reflect, you know, the myth of Medea. And so kind of those elements are fictionalized. But I would say kind of like the overall kind of backdrop and kind of the impacts of colonialism that's sort of mentioned in there, they're very much influenced, you know, they're very much inspired by actual fact in terms of the, like, for example, I picked the date where it begins, of 1757, because it's kind of this date of this battle called Battle of Plassey, which is kind of marked the beginning of East India Company rule in Bengal, and kind of the background to that, without kind of just a lot of the things, background around that whole thing is not so. It's not just about kind of military battle, but there's, you know, elements of like conspiracy and intrigue and that sort of, without going too much into spoilers, there's an element of that, I would say, in the book. So not kind of, you know, exactly what happened, but kind of definitely nods towards that. A lot of the impacts in terms of, you know, characters talk about, you know, what they would do, the East India Company, in terms of destroying industry, kind of, you know, hurting, like, for example, like the loom makers that were involved in the sort of textile industry that was really rampant and vibrant in Bengal, kind of all that happened, sort of talk about, yeah, sort of taxation and the agricultural reforms, the ecological damage that they did. That's very much true. And also because the book kind of, like Madi and Jason, kind of the characters travel around, so it doesn't just stay in India, it goes sort of elsewhere, and including the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa, which was at the time known as the Tavern of the Seas. It was kind of where sailors would kind of stop off and resupply and like food and everything, and like, so it was this massive kind of hub. And there also explored the realities of enslaved people as well, and just kind of the diversity there. And, you know, by the Dutch East India Company, which was also known as the VOC. I can't remember the Dutch of it. I don't speak Dutch. So, but yeah, so we just called it the VOC. but yeah, so kind of it, the realities of that, their kind of actions in South Africa and kind of across South Asia as well. Those are kind of all, built, sort of bedded in reality, but then kind of what individual characters do is, of course, fiction and kind of inspired by the myth. And then, yeah, kind of in the back of the book, try to sort of talk a little bit about kind of the realities of it in North's notes. And then if people are interested and sort of learn more, you know, to learn more and kind of delve into the history a bit more than they can do.
Oh, I mean, this is fascinating on so many counts. Like, for one, I think it's so cool and interesting that there is this myth that is sort of so perfect. I mean, in so many ways, because Medea is amazing, but also like, that it was so kind of ripe for you to be able to explore, you know, not only the issues of colonialism in, you know, like, and specifically like the East India Company, but also then be able to utilize the Argo of it all, the like actual journey, and just explore this like different part of the world, and then be able to touch upon so many other historical aspects and still weave in the myth so perfectly. Like, it seems like so kind of perfect for that kind of story, because you get this ability to be like, well, they're going to sail off, so I can kind of, you know, examine all the other things that were happening at the time and sort of like utilize those parts in the story to talk about like other things, you know, and then to be able to put it at the end and have, you know, further reading and stuff is so great. Like, I just think generally that it's like more than about time to have Greek myths and put into like non-Western contexts, because they do get used in this Western lens so often. Like, you know, even just the example you were saying about, you know, naming ships and stuff, like, and them, the British feeling like they were the inheritors of it, like, that has turned, that has made Greek myths and like ancient Greece generally into this, like, oftentimes dog whistle for white supremacy and like Western supremacy generally. And so it's so great to be able to have a, you know, this kind of retelling that sort of like literally turns that on its head. Like, you know, it's like you couldn't possibly go further in the opposite direction. And that's just cool. So I'm glad it exists.
I think so too. Absolutely. There's I guess first of all, just in terms of, yeah, kind of how it's been used to sort of bolster kind of this myth of, yeah, kind of white supremacy and kind of, you know, Western imperialism, that's definitely true. And I think definitely kind of you can start to see the beginnings of that kind of during the time that I'm writing, which is also, I guess, was another, wasn't kind of what the story was about, but I think definitely was a bit of an influence in terms of the setting as well, thinking about, you know, particularly in the UK, you do see this rise in, you know, interest in classicism, in, you know, the architecture, in the like dress styles, even just kind of the rise of archaeology, and like, and how often a lot of the wealth that was used, you know, kind of generated through colonialism was then used to kind of perpetuate that. So, like, for example, in Scotland, where I think they're definitely sort of disproportionately represented in terms of plantation owners back then. There might have been a quarter of plantations in the Caribbean. Yeah, owned by Scottish owners, but a lot of that wealth kind of went to sort of generate sort of Scotland, and sort of which was seen as like a new Athens in terms, you know, and it's very much linked to this Enlightenment period as well, which again sort of they saw themselves as the inheritors of like, you know, Greek philosophers and, you know, kind of the Romans in terms of empire building and all of that. So it's very much linked to that. And I think also it's very much linked to colonialism in terms of a lot of narrative that you get, particularly like previously, I feel like, yeah, there is starting to be like in more mainstream, a lot more of kind of actual assessment of the impact of colonialism. But, you know, for a long time, there was sort of this idea of like, well, you know, the imperial powers brought so much to these kind of, you know, brought the railways, this, you know, invention and progress and all of that. And that absolutely, you know, doesn't take into account just how much it impeded and stopped a lot of the innovation that was flourishing in countries at the time, and just how, you know, for example, when the East India Company started trading in India sort of back in the 1600s, India was responsible for, I think, 22% of the world's GDP, and I think England about 2%. And by the time they left India, those percentages were reversed. So, you know, when you think about just what a mega power in, you know, India was at that time, and how kind of flourishing it was, how it was just this, you know, at the time when I'm writing about, it was ruled by the Mughals, and they were, you know, very much interested in education and sciences and art, and just, you know, sort of this huge intellectual flourishing. But we're not kind of taught that, or kind of, you know, that sort of stuff isn't discussed. And it's just this kind of idea of Western sort of enlightenment and progress is perpetuated instead. So I think that definitely is linked to a lot of the the way that sort of supposed legacy from like the Greeks to like, I don't know, modern days, in terms of like perpetuating this idea of white supremacy.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it all comes down to these ideas that we were sort of fed, and certainly like even more so, you know, in the last few hundred years. But that, like, yeah, enlightenment is the good word for it, of like, you know, all the things that the Greeks brought. And then so if the British are the inheritors of that, then they're only bringing good things. And like, oh, they're just bestowing their wisdom, their technology on these like quote unquote primitive people, you know, like
civilizing them.
Exactly. Yeah. That civilizing word. Right. Which is, I mean, I think why hearing you talk about it, it's like, it's why Medea is such a perfect character, because she is the other, she is the barbarian, she is, you know, like, yeah, I mean, gods, that part is always so fascinating about her generally. Like, when I learned that, I was like blown away because I think I'd heard that story so often without that additional really important context that she's like not Greek. And I think too, like, even when we hear that so often, like if you don't understand how the Greeks saw not Greek, you still don't get it, right? Like you have to know that like barbarian context of like, no, like that's where the word comes from. You're not Greek, you're a barbarian. Like you're, you know, you don't matter. All these different things, especially, you know, in the time period of Euripides and in Athens specifically. But even just like the time period you're talking about makes me think of like, you know, all the grand tours that all the rich boys were taking,
absolutely,
right? Like visiting Greece. And it makes me think of, and I don't know the timeline for this, it's certainly later, but probably not that much. But I think that, you know, of Lord Elgin, I don't know if it's a hard or soft G, but going in and taking all the Parthenon marbles and just like...
Absolutely. I think when I was first thinking about Jason, like, I think, yeah, Lord Elgin definitely was actually a massive influence. And yeah, sort of, I think it really was the Parthenon friezes in the British Museum that kind of, I think almost that was the light bulb moment, thinking about that and thinking about Jason. I was just like, what is he doing? Just going up there and just thinking he can take this because he wants it. And it's the British Museum is I don't have time to get into all of that, but it's just appalling how museums continue to profit and kind of benefit from stolen artifacts, and they know that they're stolen, they know that the provenance is spurious and, you know, sort of dubious at best, and continues to maintain the colonial patronizing mindset in terms of that, you know, they're better if they're kept here or anything like that. It's just appalling.
I mean not to, like, you know, not to turn it away too much from you know your setting and everything too, but it just makes me think even of like how, you know, how modern Greece was treated in the past few hundred years, right? It's like Britain became the inheritors, like the quote unquote West became the inheritors of ancient Greece, and modern Greece got none of it. Modern Greece became it's like they were completely separated from their heritage in favor of it being given to these people who were more explicitly, like, you know, quote unquote white, like more Western, everything. It's like Greece even lost it, like Elgin came in and took everything because Greece couldn't deal with it. And even still, like you're saying, like they still maintain this idea that they're better off in the British Museum, which, like, yes, not to get too deep into it, but just to make sure my listeners know, in case I haven't said it recently, like there is a constant leak in the room where the Parthenon marbles are held. You can find so many pictures of buckets on the floor catching the water where the Parthenon marbles are held in the British Museum, whereas Athens built an enormous, state-of-the-art, beautiful museum to hold them.
The museum is stunning. Gorgeous.
It's amazing. The layout, is so incredible. Listeners, if the first floor is like everything that they found around the rock, the second floor is everything on the rock that isn't the Parthenon. The third floor is the Parthenon, and they laid it out like literally so that it like mirrors the actual Parthenon on the rock, which is like a stone's throw away. Like it is positioned in the same direction, and it is like the height are like as if you were really walking around it looking, and they're all copies because they're all in the British Museum. And anyway, needless to say, I feel strongly about that. I'm going to Athens for I think the seventh time in 2 weeks, and I've still never seen the Parthenon marbles. And I think that is like so telling. It's like,
I first went on a school trip when I when I was at school, and it was the absolute embarrassment, the shame of going around with our tour guide who very pointedly and rightly pointed out that so there are something missing here.
I love the Greeks are assholes about it now. Like they're like, we're going to tell you about the stuff you stole and you won't give back. Like they're so strong
absolutely
about it. I love
right.
it.
Yeah. Absolutely yeah. right. Yeah. No. And it's true. Like kind of because they're not keeping it proper. And then that doesn't even. And then there's all the things that's not even on display in terms of things that's just in storage. And some museums are starting to give stuff back, and that's absolutely right, but there's so many still aren't, and it's really it's just hard to just like it's just impossible to justify It's and actually in sort of just going briefly back to Beck, some of the there's something that I no, just because it suddenly reminded me that that something in my kind of towards the end is kind of like an artifact is kind of identified in the home, and it's very much influenced by a lot of the artifacts from India that's in Powers Castle, which is where kind of the descendants of the son of Robert Clive lived. So kind of things that were taken during that time and still here. They're Powers Castles and Wells. So yeah, you can still find it here. So yeah, kind of huge amount of things that were stolen are still kind of in sort of stately homes in UK. And to be fair to the organisation, National Trust, that kind of do maintain those, they are getting better at actually kind of talking about the colonial history of that. And they have this whole project, Colonial Countryside, that kind of looks at how, these items that are kind of in these homes, and also kind of the wealth that these homes were built with, and how kind of it's just very much linked to colonialism. And it's something that is just right throughout the UK, and I imagine a lot of the sort of Anglophone world.
Yeah, well, and I've never really thought about it that way. Like, I mean, I think about the artifacts a lot and Providence and all the issues there, but as somebody who again is Canadian, like we don't have those like stately homes. We don't have that kind of, and more so in the East, there is a bit more of that, like that level of colonialism that led to these enormous shows of colonial wealth. But we don't have anything like the UK, because we don't we were built as a country of colonialism, but like in a kind of different way, not as like a wealth. There's a lot of wealth that's all colonial, but it just, the context isn't there. But the idea of these places that were just people's homes, and then they stole stuff and kept it, and the idea that stuff is still there like that, like that's something I would have never thought about. That's amazing that you're able to kind of fit that in. And like, I mean, I feel like there's so much that you were probably able to like fit in terms of this colonial aspect. And it does fit so well with Greece, because they were colonial power too. And I mean, I don't want to say that they're anything like the UK, because I think the British really, really just took hold and took it all really up excel. To a new level.
10 out of 10, really. Like, just well, top marks. The Athenians, kind of particularly, kind of their sort of empire and kind of supremacy. I remember, when I did my classics degree, we studied the Parthenon, and I think I had an essay question that was something along the lines of, it's as much a kind of monument to its I can't remember if the word colonialism was actually used, or it's Athenian kind of imperial might, as it is like sort of Athena, or I can't remember the exact question, but it was kind of like leading you to kind of look at how it was built, and kind of the money to the Delian League and everything, and just how that's very much was prevalent then. And also thinking about, kind of talked about the, sort of political context I was writing in. Think about Euripides. It was kind of the time of Pericles, right? And his citizenship laws, and how the real impacts of having, children with a foreign woman was very much a live issue at that time. And so, very much I think that would have been quite, really recognisable in terms of, the audience that, he was playing to. And just kind of, it would have, like all great Athenian tragedy, it's kind of about that time and that place and the, myth, but then it's also really about themselves, right? And kind of what's happening to them. So it's, how they, like you said, how they kind of treated sort of non-Greeks, and just sort of the impacts of those in terms of real people's lives, I think would have been very much on their minds watching Medea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I mean, I like to give Euripides all the credit in the whole world. Give him every benefit of the doubt, for sure. But like, I mean, I'm curious, like, how, I mean, I certainly he was intending it, like, because you're right, like, the time period, you know, and particularly being in Athens, which was the most strict in terms of women and in terms of marriage and like, in the strictures of that, like, Athens was the worst, you know, like, by far. And so while it takes place in Corinth, like, Euripides is writing about Athens. He's just placing it in Corinth. It's like how, you know, like, I swear, like, 60% of Greek tragedies are placed in Thebes so that they can, like, write about a foreign city while also commenting on Athens. But yeah, the Medea of it all is fascinating because it's like not even just like the, you know, having children with a foreigner and her being a foreigner, but it's like also that like she believed she and Jason were married, but Jason is like, nope, because you know, you're a foreigner, so we're not even officially married. Like, I don't even have any, like, he doesn't have anything that he's not beholden to her in any way. He can do whatever the fuck he wants because she is this barbarian. And so now, like, that leads me to, like, I'm kind of fascinated by how that comes up in your book, because, you know, you're writing in this colonial time period, and obviously you've got, I love the James, by the way, I meant to say that earlier, like, James and Mina is like the greatest way to make them both like of their own culture while also being like, look who they are though. Like, James feels like totally equivalent to Jason in terms of just like useless douchebag. So just, yeah, really stood out to me. But like, so yeah, how did you kind of, and I, you know, stop me if anything's going to be spoily, obviously. But like, when it comes to that foreigner aspect, I imagine it's interesting because, I mean, I just want to hear anything kind of about that foreigner aspect, I guess, because it's sort of a weirder, because you've said it's so colonial, where like the foreigners are in the foreign place, but like, obviously the, you know, the British still are the British of it all. So I'm just kind of, that wasn't really a question, but if you could speak to that at all, I'm really interested.
So, I guess thinking about the kind of marriage, non-marriage aspect, because, she's a foreigner and so isn't, you know, entitled to the, you know, rights and protections or, you know, just sort of all of that, that she would be as a Greek woman. Without wanting to go into spoilers, that is definitely explored in the book. And it's, I guess, again, thinking about what I was sort of doing in my day job at the time, like, it's definitely something that is very much present, you know, today, where you'll get sort of as, you know, a part, as a form of abuse, kind of to keep migrant women in a kind of position of vulnerability. They're kind of, they're sort of regularizing kind of marriage or kind of their immigration status. That's kind of in, you know, sort of partners won't do that or, you know, will kind of delay doing that in order to maintain kind of that control or just kind of ensure that they're not kind of in a position of power. They can, you know, actually leave or, you know, access any sort of protection and support. So that's definitely something that is very prevalent actually, and is just something that happens regularly, and kind of in the story they travel around, and so I think and travel to kind of different parts and, you know, sort of meet myth, you know, certain characters that, you know, we know and love, who are related to kind of the Jason and Medea myth, without kind of wanting to go into any details. And I think you can definitely see differences in how James, you know, kind of feels and acts, you know, where he's able to really tap into that, you know, the benefit of being a white European man from, you know, a wealthy family, and, you know, where sort of Mina has more kind of more of a support network, more of, you know, kind of equal footing. And so I think you can see that throughout the book, where he, you know, where that kind of places where sort of that foreigner aspect to her identity is emphasized, he feels kind of more comfortable, and sort of where that's emphasized, he feels less.
Yeah, like where he holds the power. That's exactly. So interesting. Yeah.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but, like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Okay, it leads me to a fun question, which is that, so obviously, you know, you're not setting this in Greek mythology. You can't deal with the gods or divinity or anything. So is there like a favorite part of Medea's story that you were like, I really can't make this into the real world? Like, is there something that you really wish you could have made work in your book?
I'm trying to decide if this is a spoiler or not. I don't think so. Well, just in terms of the very specifics of her grandfather being the son and, you know, having a dragon chariot. Sadly, a little short on dragon chariots back in the 18th Damn. Century. So, it's definitely something that I just love from the myth. It's such, you know, such an iconic scene, that, you know, at the end of the play where she's up in the crane and everything. It's just like
the best.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that there's a vase, I think the other day I said Greek vase, but I think it might be during Roman times. Yeah, I think you know the one I mean, where it's kind of depicting that scene, and it's so cool. Like the dragons, like the way they're like drawn, are just like amazing and coyly and just like, yeah, awesome. So that would have been amazing to the pitch, but obviously kind of working within the realm where, you know, everyone's mortal, can't quite do that, but try to have a couple nods here and there. So hopefully if you're looking for that, you can sort of see where, you know, where those little sort of fun references are.
Love that. Yeah, that was definitely what I was expecting you to answer, because the dragon chariot is so great, and also I imagined you couldn't exactly fit it into your story, unfortunately. Yeah. It makes me just think
of, we would have all buy a dragon chariot if we could, right?
Absolutely. But yeah, that pottery that you're talking about is so cool. And to the listeners, we'll make sure that it's in the little promo video on my Instagram for this episode. But yeah, she not only is she driving a badass dragon chariot in that pottery, but they also really made her look foreign in a way that I think is super impactful. And like, yeah, she doesn't always look that foreign, but yeah, in that one, like, they gave her this whole like hat thing that's very not Greek. Like, she very much looks like this badass barbarian woman driving a dragon chariot.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's, yeah, I think it's a really great depiction of her. You know, because I guess obviously throughout centuries we've had lots, you know, you get lots of European kind of depictions of her. But it's just, yeah, I love her at her most, like, most foreign, most godly kind of, self.
Mm-hmm. It just reminds me, in very European traditions of her, just before I got on this call, I was on Twitter, and another author I recently spoke to for the podcast, Luna McNamara, she tweeted, I got everybody on right now. It's so exciting. But she tweeted some, like, she had like a Spider-Man reference to it, which was funny, but basically that Waterhouse painting, I think it's Waterhouse because he's usually my favorite, of like where Jason is like leaning in and watching Medea so intently, and he looks like his usual Jason self and that he's totally useless, and Medea's like pouring some vial into some magical something, and she just looks so right. Yeah, she looks so serious and cool.
Yeah. No, it's I do love a lot of those European people. Just, I don't know, a lot of the depictions that really just kind of capture her, like, at her most magical, like, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. There is also this, for something that's very different, there's this Indian artist called Nalini Malani, who she references Madeira a lot, actually, in her work to explore those themes of the colonized and the colonized. And she did this, like, quite strange looking, honestly, like sort of charcoal drawing of Madeira. I think it's called Madeira's Mutant, and it's kind of a kind of drawing of a sort of Madeira, kind of a body, but like, it's quite, you can't necessarily, doesn't have a lot of detail to it. It's it doesn't look very kind of human, to be honest, let alone female. It's quite kind of roughly drawn, and it's got little kind of eraser marks kind of all sort of in it. And it feels like it's very much trying to capture that kind of dehumanized erasure kind of sense of like her being a foreign woman. And it's just, I really like it because it's so different to any other kind of depiction of Madeira I've ever seen, and it's just it's really fascinating.
I'm gonna try to remember to send you an email so you can send me that, if that's okay, so that I can share it with the episode, because that sounds really fascinating, and I love the idea of sharing a version of her that is sort of explicitly like exploring those same themes, because for all I love the Waterhouse ones, like, I mean, it's definitely not negating the colonialism of it all.
I guess it's all just about like variety. And that's, I think, the beauty of myths, right? Kind of, they're these like ancient stories with like these compelling characters that just kind of, they're designed to be just kind of retold and reinterpreted and reimagined. But, you know, and it's just having lots of different perspectives allows us to have lots of different interpretations. I mean, obviously, I've written this book, but I think it's also worth noting that there are kind of have been other versions of the myth told by other people of color who, you know, throughout years, who have done like an amazing job in the, you know, different contexts, like, for example, obviously Toni Morrison's Beloved, I think, is probably the most well-known in terms of,
I always forget, like, that's Medea.
She studied classics at Howard, so yeah, she's like, she was very like steeped in like the myth.
There's
words can't describe how extraordinary kind of that book is, and just kind of looking at the aftermath of kind of that sort of action, and was inspired by real life woman who was known as Modern Medea. And then also I think there's a book by Percival Everett who I haven't read, but that's called For Her Dark Skin. That sounds really intriguing as well, and similarly is kind of Black American kind of take on Medea. I know that there's like a Mexican American almost kind of dystopian dystopian play that kind of explores it as well. So like there are kind of other sort of post-colonial and kind of intersectional kind of reading, you know, the versions of her and the myth by people of colour. It's just, I think, yeah, need to bring them to the fore a little bit more, because I think it's definitely worth, you know, perspective worth sort of emphasising, particularly when it comes to this myth.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad you brought all of those up. I'm going to try to do some Googling so I can link to them as well. Because, yeah, I agree. I mean, and I think it's wonderful that Medea is so ripe for that. And exactly mm-hmm. what you said earlier, which is that, like, I mean, these myths themselves, they exist to be retold. That's like, you know, oral storytelling is that. Like, we don't even know what versions of them used to exist, mm-hmm. let alone the ones that can come now, you know, like that is the whole point. And I think there's a subset of people who feel so strongly that the ancient Greeks and the ancient Greek myths are like this untouchable perfection. And it's funny that I say this now, because yesterday Twitter was like absolutely awash with a lot of them were explicitly white supremacists, but I'm just going to assume that they all were, who were like, so they made Odysseus trend because of, like,
I saw that this, today, and I was very confused. So yeah, please leave
me. Yeah, I forget how it started. I know a large part of it was a tweet by Joel Christensen, I think it started with Joel's been on my show to talk about Homer, and now we're going to do an Odysseus episode after what happened. Yes. But it started with, I think, some conservative tweeting that, like, you know, that, like, I think it was something along the lines of, which these come up a lot, the idea that, like, men today aren't like Odysseus and or like whoever, right? It's always a stand-in for some Greek hero. like men are so bad today because they're not Odysseus. And then I think it was Joel who got into shit by being,
then,
like,
I get all of their friends killed.
Yeah, exactly. So Joel literally tweeted, it was like a list of everything that Odysseus does, which is like, yeah, all of his friends die, like all of his ships are destroyed, he threw a baby off a tower, like he slaughtered enslaved women for no other reason than they were enslaved and did what they were forced to do. And it's like, and then that just, like, blew up, and a bunch of people in my sort of Twitter circle were getting hounded for all of this stuff. But, like, it's this, like, ongoing and wild thing. And, like, it, I mean, I say wild, but, like, I'm not surprised by it anymore. I just wish it would stop all the same. But this, like, these conservative, typically men, white supremacist, basically always. One guy definitely used the word Aryan at some point. So I'm like, well, you made it obvious. Yeah. But, like, these people who just think that the Greek myths, the Greek stories are untouchable, like they just, you know, need to remain exactly what they are because they're perfect and they show this, like, world that we should just strive for. It's like, I don't know what you're reading. Like, I know the issue is that, like, I will never understand your brain because you're, like, a broken human, these people who say these things. But, like, yeah, anyway, that's all to bring it back to this idea that, like, the myths need to be retold.
This definition of tell me you know nothing about Greek myths without telling me you know nothing about the Greek myths.
Yeah, like their entire purpose was to be retold. Like, Euripides was retelling Medea in his play. He's the one who made her kill her children. That did not exist before him, and it became this staple of the myth. But for all we know, he invented that. Like, it you know, it's impossible to say for sure, but, like, based on our sourcing, he invented it, and yet it became part of the myth. But if we look at Euripides, like, technically speaking, he should not be the arbiter of a myth. He is the arbiter of his play. He wrote a play. It's like saying, you know, that a movie adaptation of something then becomes the canon, and you're like, well, no, it's an adaptation, but because the Greek tragedies are often what we have as sources, and because they are so ancient, we forget that. We forget that a tragedy is an adaptation. It has artistic license. And anyway, like, all to say, like, retellings are great and good and important. And particularly ones like decolonized ones, and these ones that explore these themes that are sort of, you know, antithetical to how the Greek stories are often misused by, you know, the worst of humanity.
Yeah, no, but it's literally, I do love the story, you know, the sort of supposed myth again, that you know, the Corinthians paid Euripides off to change the ending. So but they were, because, you know, kind of versions of it, or that the Corinthians called the children, and they're like, man, I get some bad PR. Just like change it a little bit.
I always forget about that. Yeah. 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 I mean, that's the thing, right? Like,
we have don't no idea know. Kind of what, yeah, the origins of this are. And yeah, you know, myths don't have a copyright. Like, they're not, you know, yeah, kind of, it's reproduced and invent Medea. She existed, yeah, before him and exists, you know, will exist long after him, and has so far. So yeah, it's, that's the whole purpose of myth. And it's the same with Homer and, you know, Ovid and everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what makes them so fun. Mm. Like, when we suggest that we can't, like, change and retell and adapt these stories, like, I mean, not only does it have all these problematic connotations, but it's also like, why? Like, it's fun. The myths have always been fun, and they should be fun. And, like, yeah, I mean, making them what we want them to be, making them our own, is, like, literally the point, and what makes them so interesting. And the same with the idea of sourcing and Medea not being, you know, original to Euripides, and her being mysterious, and the fact that we don't know, you know, yeah, why he had her kill her children. Like, is it because he wanted it? Is it because it fit the story? Is it because the Corinthians paid him? I like the idea that it was intentional on his part, because I really do think that he makes her really empathetic. So, like, I'm very on the side of it was Euripides, you know, making a conscious choice in his writing. But I do love the rumors, right? Like, yeah, I forgot about that.
Exactly.
Rumor, so thank you for bringing it up.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think I think you can't write something that, yeah, that compelling and emotive, and yeah, really, really affecting. Like, it gets me every time I saw Sophia Canedo performance of Medea in London recently, and she was just astonishing in it. And it's just, you know, obviously I know the story, I know how it's gonna end, but, like, it's still just deeply, deeply affecting. And I don't think you can do that without, yeah, I don't think you could have written that without doing something quite intentional and purposeful with that. But yeah, myths are meant to be retold, and just they're fun. That's the whole point of myths and literature. And I know that's why I think I love all of the retellings that are coming out. I think it's such an exciting time for, you know, Greek myths and sort of exploring that. And I hope then this boom will lead to a flourishing of stories from retellings of myths from other cultures as well, because mm-hmm. so many amazing extraordinary myths from around the world that deserves, you know, a wider audience. But I also really love, you know, retellings that do play with the myths a little, just because, yeah, I guess being a fan of the original myths, I just always like kind of seeing what other people were doing with them. Like, one of my all-time favorites is Home Fire by Camilla Shamsie, which sort of takes the Antigone myth and then kind of sets it in sort of modern day Britain, and kind of explores sort of Islamophobia and foreign terror and all of that sort of thing. And it was just, yeah, still was one of the most powerful things I've read. And, you know, and before that, there was, you know, again, sort of Antigone on Jean-Louis, I think that's how you pronounce the name, French playwright who sort of did a version sort of during Nazi occupied France, and, you know, was writing, basically kind of wrote in that element of sort of resistance against, you know, fascistic regime. So it's, there's, yeah, lots of exciting things. And I haven't read Maya Deen's novel yet, of course, but I really want to. I think the idea of a trans Achilles is so cool and just so, like, perfect. And I'm so in love at this time with, like, people just bringing up new and exciting versions and takes on these myths. So yeah, I hope it continues.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, selfishly, I hope it continues because it, like, absolutely supports my career. But, like, yeah, I mean, I you know, I'm fine with it. But I also I've had Wrath Goddess Sing on my shelf. I'm just looking at it now. I'm like, oh, but that's, yeah, to the listeners, Maya Deen's Wrath Goddess Sing, which I've never mentioned on the show, and I absolutely should have. Yeah, I mean, what I'm so excited about, completely selfishly, like, I'm excited by all of the retellings that are coming out now, because there are so many, and it's great, and I agree, though, like, I do hope that we can transition into a place where they're not all Greek, because I think, yeah, so many other cultures deserve, you know, their stories to be retold as well. Obviously, I'm partial to the Greek because that's my entire purpose. But personally, and again, selfishly, I love that, like, retellings like yours, and I hope there are more like that, that take the myth, and like Home Fire too, like take the myth and adapt it, like place it somewhere else, use the story to tell a different story. Not least because I think that, like, especially, you know, with Home Fire and with yours, where you're getting to address these colonial aspects and this like important topics that are relevant today, utilizing a Greek myth. But personally, because I spend like 90% of my time reading Greek myth, I like ones that aren't straight retellings, because every time I read a straight retelling now, like, I feel like I've broken myself, because I read it and I'm like, I know what's going to happen. You're not going to surprise me. I want to be surprised, but like, I know everything that happens in the myths, and it just like lives in my brain all the time. Yeah. So when I get ones like yours where it's like, I don't know what's going to happen. How exciting. What you're working with, but yeah.
I totally get that. Yeah. I think there is an element for me as well, kind of as a writer, kind of, I know, I guess also like when you're writing a book is hard, like it takes ages and there's so like such a long editing process. But yeah, like you have to really like the book you're writing. And I think for me to continue to be entertained and kind of interested in what I'm writing, I think I need to have something that is new and different and kind of puts a new spin on it, just to keep myself entertained, and then hopefully kind of readers will feel the same. I think also there's an element of just like taking pressure off yourself, because if I were to try and compare myself to Euripides, I would just massively inadequate, because I think he's a genius. So it's just like, you know, it gives me then space to make something that is just wholly my own, and just, you know, a different, you know, a whole another creation that just really tells a story that I want to tell, rather than what I think has been told before, and, you know, what potentially people expect.
Yeah I mean, Euripides is a genius. That's a simple fact. I think so highly of him. Like, it's really, I feel like I put him on this like absurd pedestal at this point. But I also like to think that, like, based on what he writes as a person, I also think that he would like really appreciate like stories like yours and other like these retellings that like emphasize different things, and like, I don't know. That's just apparently I want to talk about Euripides.
Someone who's interested in like telling stories in a different way. Like, he definitely he wouldn't have written Medea that way. And like, I don't know, even just like thinking about how he handles kind of the Orestes myth, and just, you know, thinking about what sort of went before in terms of Aeschylus, and like, you know, clearly very much trying to do something different there. Like, he seems very interested in like writing in response to what went before, you know. And, you know, I guess we don't really think about like Greek things as being reception, but it almost feels kind of reception in that way, in terms of how like it's how he's writing his version in the myth, like in response to what's gone before. And it's I think he's very interested in that, and I think that's why I really like him as well.
Yeah he's interested in that, and he's so specifically interested in women, that's why I love him. Like, he really just was like, they don't have to be perfect and good or just evil. Like, I think Medea is the perfect example of that. Like, she is good and bad in equal measures, and that's what he's interested in, and I think that's what makes her so compelling and fascinating, and why I love her and Euripides forever.
And he's also, sorry, we're getting on a massive like Euripides tangent, but just something also thinking about how he, like, the different ways he explores characters, even, you know, across different plays, like Helen, for example. Like, the Helen of, you know, Trojan Women is so different to the Helen of Helen. And like, it's just, it's fascinating, and like, it's so cool he's able to really, like, you know, like chalk and cheese in terms of like the depiction and how kind of they're meant to evoke sympathy. Like, it's just, it's really fascinating, and it's I love how his treatment of women as well, and how he's able to just kind of bring out complexity and empathy where kind of there may not have been in other, you know, previous versions of the myth.
yep Yep, exactly. Oh my gosh. Okay. I'm going to, yeah, I could go on about Euripides forever, but I will not. I want to make sure that we close this with more about your book, but also Euripides is amazing. I don't know. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you were like, that was kind of your goal in writing this? And I don't want to put you on the spot. It's hard to come up with an answer that's so broad, or to a question that's so broad. But yeah, I mean, like, what did you kind of want to get out of this, I guess? Like, other than, you know, a retelling of Medea, and I don't know. Is that a decent question?
I think that's a good question. I guess in terms of what I wanted to get out of this, I guess, yeah, kind of, you know, starting off very small, I wanted to write a book that I, you know, was interesting to me. And for me, that was, you know, trying to do something new and different and exciting with the myth. I wanted to rightly kind of, yeah, center the marginalized aspects of her identity, which I felt that, you know, had been slightly under-discussed, I guess, for centuries, and kind of needed to be kind of to the forefront. And in doing so, I guess I hoped that it could also, yeah, shine a light on a part of history that I'm not super, you know, haven't been super familiar with. You know, it's not something that is part of the British education system, but, you know, kind of you know, through what is hopefully, you know, an interesting, compelling story, because the myth is, you know, just, you know, the bones of it, through the myth, it's, you know, so great in itself, allows people to actually kind of learn things that they hadn't known before, and hopefully maybe reflect on, you know, how those issues kind of permeate today, whether it's kind of the the state's treatment of migrant people, whether it's kind of white saviorism, white feminism, and how, mm-hmm. you know, kind of all of those things kind of continue to permeate today, and how you can sort of see these themes of injustice and othering kind of, I know, almost echo throughout history, from like the myth to first century Athens to the rise of colonialism to today. So I guess that was my hope and intention with the book.
Well, that is a beautiful way of saying it, and end of wrapping this up. But I think, yeah, I think that's such, it's so important, and I'm glad that Medea was kind of there for you as like as good bones for that. And I think probably it's, you know, being able to utilize her her basic story, which appeals to Western people. And white people, and then sort of adapt it into this way where it completely fits with your story, but gets to tell a different and more relevant to us today story, I think is a really impactful way of you know, bringing awareness to both, you know, the colonialist aspects and these issues that you're talking about with migrant women today. I think Medea, this is me not knowing how to take anything seriously, I think Medea would be really glad that her story is used for this.
That's so too. I think she's definitely a woman who you know, yeah, again, sort of slightly not taking it too seriously, I think she's a woman who kind of is, you know, aware of her infamy and enjoys it, you know.
Yep.
So I think she loves knowing that her story is being retold.
Yeah, she would be watching from her dragon chariot just with a big smile mm-hmm. on her face.
Exactly. Yeah. After she buried her children.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, she's not going to keep them in there.
Yeah.
Oh God. This is how I like to talk about really important things. Thank you so much for doing this. This is so much fun, and also I really do think that. The story is super important and the setting is super important, and I'm very glad that it exists for people to read, and I hope everybody does.
Thank you very much. This has been so fun, so great to be on your show, so thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you. I will you know, I can like link to things in the episode's description, but also and I think certainly the book is just going to be available for purchase wherever you get books. But is there anything else you want to share? Any place you want my listeners to follow you? Kind of anything else you want to mention here?
Sure. So yeah, if if you like the sound of the book, Savage Beast, and it's it hopefully by the time this airs will be out where you can get books. It's available only currently in UK and Commonwealth, sadly. North American rights aren't haven't been sold yet, but I believe Blackwell's do free international shipping, so if you are interested you can possibly order from there if you're in America or Canada, and also feel free to say online if you'd like the North American version, because I would like to see that as well. And you can find me on Twitter at Rani_writes, so Rani_writes like writer, and on Instagram at Rani_Selvaraja.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for doing that, and I'll link to everything there in the description, and just, it's been lovely chatting with you.
It's been lovely chatting with you as well.
As always, thank you all so much for listening. I truly love conversation episodes so much. It's so nice to have a mixture too, like of academics and scholars with their niche topics and specialties, and then amazing authors like Rani and the others that I've spoken to recently. Particularly when it comes to books like this, like, I am so fucking keen to have authors on to not only share their work and to help promote it to potential readers, but to also talk about such important topics that often get left out of this discourse around Greek mythology. Obviously, today's conversation was like all of those things, along with being generally fun and entertaining. We just had so much fun. I fucking love my job. Thank you all for helping me do it and for caring about, you know, like Medea and colonialism and like ongoing structural issues in colonial countries and beyond. It's important, obviously. So Savage Beast is Rani Selvaraja's new novel, this unique and fascinating retelling of Medea's incredible story of living as a foreign woman in a colonial world. And while it's only widely available in Commonwealth countries, the irony of which is not lost on me, Blackwell's in the UK does ship internationally. So I've linked to that really specifically in this episode's description, along with places to find Rani on social media and, with any luck, to hear about future editions of the book beyond the Commonwealth. But for now, you can get it, and you should. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians and handles so many podcast-related things, from running the YouTube to creating promotional images and videos to editing and research. Stephanie Foley works to transcribe the podcast for YouTube captions and accessibility. The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeartMedia. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/myths. Baby, or click the link in this episode's description. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty.
When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, we are going to give women meaningful beauty. And I said, that's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life.
Meaningful beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.